And while they don't know, I know that it's prob- this is probably the first year I've seen students frame the issue as well as the class did collectively. By no stretch am I suggesting that there weren't problems, but most of you seem to heed the advice that, you know, it's more complicated than who, you know, who shot the sheriff, you know. And so that was good. I noted, I believe, the other day that the restating of the rule was just awful. My suspicion is that that'll be true as I go through the second set of blue books on over the weekend. But we'll see. You must do those first two pieces well. Otherwise, you stand no chance of doing the analytical part of Iraq. And that's particularly true about restating the rule of law. Defining the issue properly narrows down the rules of law that are likely to apply in a particular situation. And for the first 2 weeks, we have single issue problems. As you begin to have multiple issue problems, A, recognizing that there are multiple issues, and B, being able to state the various rules of law that are applicable will be critical to your success. And so when we return to the writing exercise after we've had our discussion on homicide, I'll go over this again. The scores ranged, I think, from 2 to 4. Nobody was perfect. This is law school. That's just the way it is. But as I said, you could have gotten a 0 and it would mean nothing in terms of what your final grade is. And so there is a tendency for me to be more cantankerous early and perhaps less so for 2 reasons. One, you've actually improved. And secondly, that makes my mood better, okay? So, on your blue books, you'll see an S, a K, or a W. I've read all of the blue books. Shannon and Kyle read most of the blue books. The fact that they didn't read all of them was simply sloppy work on my part. So in addition to, if you want to converse with me, you can, but many of you will know that you can talk with Shannon and Kyle. And we went through our holistic sort of grading exercise as well today. And although they may not have a discrete critique for the ones that I sort of read alone, they have both read the other questions. And so there are ample opportunities for you to get feedback on this process. Just to avoid any... Emily, I didn't critique your brief, but I will before we leave today, so you will get it back, but everyone else appears to be fine. We're in the middle of a discussion of what kind of act do you need, what kind of mindset or mens rea do you need for there to be a crime? And we said that the act, in terms of the actus reus, the evil eye, it must be a voluntary act. That's one of the most important parts. It's my understanding that some of you are struggling with the notion of affirmative, negative, or positive and negative. I mean, it's proof that I've been doing this work too long, because it means that I've fallen into the jargon without realizing that I might sometimes lose people. So let me try to explain in 5 seconds what I mean by an affirmative act. What I mean is that the defendant actually does something. They actually steal property. They actually hit someone. They actually stab or shoot someone. That sort of thing. So that's what I mean by an affirmative act. A negative act arises when someone had a legal duty to act and they failed to do so. You know, one of the cases that we'll talk about in terms of mens rea tonight is the Fabritz case. And the government's theory is that mother can be charged and should be found guilty of child abuse because she failed to get the child medical attention. So that's a failure to act. That's an example of a negative act. So any trouble with negative versus positive act? And as an aside, if I see actus reus or mens rea in your blue books, it's going to make me crazy. What I actually want you to talk about is the rule, whatever the rule is, and the crime. But these things have labels. We'll talk about mens rea and actus reus just to make sure that in a particular statute you can tell the difference, but it's not, unless you're actually asked for a definition, that's not something that should appear in an exam. You should simply lay out the rule and simply determine whether there was adequate conduct, whether there was an adequate state of mind. Easily. The most difficult, technically difficult, philosophically difficult aspect of criminal law is understanding the concept of mens rea. And I sort of figured that out a long time ago and tend to do it very quickly and move into the cases so that people have a context for the discussion, because I think that you know, there are eggheads around the world who spend their lives writing on this concept of mens rea. Okay, I'm not one of them, and you don't need to be. But mens rea is clearly something important. You know, in the De Macy case, his guilt or innocence is going to turn upon what we call mens rea, whether he had the requisite intent. So intent for a particular crime is important. Okay. But we don't need to get into metaphysical, philosophical discussions about those things. These are the things that you need to remember about mens rea. One is that we have two approaches to this. We have a common law approach and we have a model penal code approach. Under the common law
the mens rea will be general intent or specific. And in order to answer that question, you will have to read the criminal statute that the person has been accused of violating. So in the prison case, where the guy believes, knows that he has HIV, knows that the guards are, the officers are ignorant about how one contracts HIV, the issue is, does he have the requisite intent for attempted murder, or some of the other crimes that he has? Because objectively, which is, I shouldn't say subjectively, he knows that he can't carry out his threat. The threat being to infect someone with the HIV virus. But he also subjectively knows that these folks are ignorant or don't understand, and so they believe it. And so he knows that he's putting them in fear, even though they have nothing to fear. So you know, the question becomes, in that case, what is the intent? And does he have the requisite intent to commit the crimes for which he's charged? And the same thing with other cases. We'll go through them, but I just wanted to use that as an example. Typically, when we talk about the difference between general intent versus specific intent, we're saying that the language either describes how the act is done, or it describes the state of mind that the accused must have at the time that he or she is committing the crime. In this part is general intent, in this part is specific intent, because it's goal-oriented. Okay, you want a particular thing to happen. Now, part of where I probably left you all in the dust last night was I began to throw out some phrases or words. But the words are things like intentionally, willfully, wantonly, maliciously, knowingly. So you will see those words in common law. You see them in a statute. And so as to whether or not a crime is a general intent crime or a specific intent crime will depend upon whether one of those words is being used to describe the act, or whether it's being offered to show the mental state of the perpetrator at the time that they committed the act. Okay? Did they have a particular objective or goal in mind? And part of the reason, and by the way, this is really, this is about as short a list of the ways that we can describe the act or intent as possible. There are lots of other words. You'll see them as we go through the literature, but I just want to give you some sense of how they might appear. So I think I have five words up there. The difference between the common law and the model penal code is that with the model penal code, you really only have four. There'll never be more than four. If you're in a model penal code jurisdiction, it's either going to be intentional, knowing, reckless, or negligent. It can't be any of those other things. Those other words are not going to appear. And so it's simply incumbent upon us
And there's a sample of the model penal code interpreting these words in your book to understand what the model penal code actually means. I can give you some hints that under the model penal code, these are the crimes that are going to be punished harshly. These are likely to be felonies. These are going to be your more serious crimes. And we say that because of the moral blameworthiness of the defendant. He or she doesn't sort of fall into this situation. They do so intentionally or purposefully with the desire to have a particular outcome. Or they do it with knowingly, with an extremely high level of awareness that they're about to cause harm. And so those are the really bad guys. We want to get them off the streets. With reckless and negligent, we're talking about people who are doing something that is unlawful. Their conduct is outrageous. It's unjustified. And then what separates the two will be the certainty the certainty of the harm. The higher the probability, and then the ignoring of that high probability. But they share much in common. Conduct is unlawful, it's outrageous, it's unjustified, it exposes people to harm, and ultimately the question will be the actual level of awareness. Or what we're willing to imply they should know. And that's going to be a fact-based determination. So there is no clear-cut answer. So. So you can't draw easy parallels between the model penal code approach to mens rea and the common law, because it doesn't necessarily fit into neat boxes. And so you need to understand that you have to be bilingual when talking about model penal, when talking about mens rea. You have to figure out whether you're in a common law jurisdiction or if you're in a model penal code jurisdiction. And then simply go on and interpret the statute from there. Uh, as I mentioned yesterday, there are a number of states that have adopted most of the model penal code, but Massachusetts is not one of them. So we are a combination of common law, and by common law, I mean this law that evolves from judges writing opinions, and it sort of becomes the operative law. So the easy way to think of it is people will frequently call it judge-made law. And in times you do have judge-made law. And so that runs afoul of one of the civic lessons that you all grew up with, is that the legislature makes the laws, the executive branch imposes the law, and the courts interpret the law. Well, the courts do more than that. There are times when the court actually makes law. Okay. Most of the time today, courts are interpreting the law. But even today, there are times when they make law. So,
were you S-I and then
I-K?
What is the
I-K? Yeah, sure. I was about to go back there. When you see these combination of words, there's a very high probability that you are in a specific intent jurisdiction, or dealing with a specific intent crime. Because it's the attempt to do something because you want a particular outcome. You know, like the woman who was recently convicted for attempting to have a hitman kill her husband. So she had that, she put into motion a chain of events that could have resulted in her husband's death. Okay. Frequently you'll see a crime that says with intent to, and oftentimes that will also be a specific intent crime. Okay, with intent to. And the same here with assault with intent to. Oftentimes, that too is a specific intent crime. Yes?
So, with the case of the prisoner with HIV, why wasn't that a specific intent crime? Because
one of the things we have to, it actually was.
Oh, okay.
It actually was.
Okay.
Part of what happens is that we'll come to, let me go through the rest of this and we'll come back to them. Because that's the first case that we're going to go through, and I want to do it in context.
Sorry, just because you brought it up under general intent.
You mean under specific intent?
You had brought that case up when you were talking about general intent.
I'm not so sure. If I did, I didn't mean to. But I think my point was that at that time is that there were two mechanisms at work. You had someone who has the HIV virus.
He couldn't actually have done it, so
right.
It turned out it would be better classified in general.
No,
actually
it wouldn't be. Because even though subjectively he knows he can't do what he wants to do, objectively, and typically when we talk about measuring whether there's criminal activity or not, it more often than not, it's actually an objective test as opposed to a subjective test. So what was running through the mind of the victim
was the victim in fear.
So could both sides, could one side be arguing general and the other side be arguing specific?
Yeah, it's possible.
Okay.
But that case is actually a little bit easier to sort through. So with most crimes, we have an act, we have an evil mind, we will have causation, that is some relationship between the act, the mind, and the harm. So that's with most crimes. You know, if you have someone who has stabbed the person 21 times, we've got causation. The act of stabbing caused the death. Right? There are a few crimes that do not have an element of mens rea. We call those strict liability offenses. In its most fundamental form, with a strict liability crime, the only question we're asking is, did the defendant do the act? That's all we care about. We don't care about their mental state. We don't care about their mens rea. They're being punished simply because they did the act. There is a bias in the law against having strict liability crimes. But having said that, they still exist. The more harshly an act is punished, the less likely it would be a strict liability offense. So most of your strict liability crimes are crimes that are malum prohibitive. That is, society has deemed this to be dangerous, but there isn't anything inherently dangerous about the act. The strict liability offenses frequently are regulatory things, things designed to police the marketplace, or things designed to make a community more inhabitable. But you could still exist in those communities with this conduct. It just makes it more pleasant. Now, not all crimes that are strict liability crimes, not all of them are sort of Mickey Mouse crimes. There are two in particular that come to mind. And to some extent, they help to prove the rule, because they really are pretty much the only two major felonies that are strict liability offenses. One would be statutory rape. And as we will talk about next week, the other is a form of criminal homicide. To be more precise, it is a theory for proving murder. And we call that felony murder. And felony murder occurs
when a person commits a crime and a death results from them doing that inappropriate, illegal act. And so we say, because you did the felony, we don't care what your intentions were. We're going to call you a murderer in the first or second degree. But those are the two huge exceptions to this notion of strict liability. So, you know, you'll have strict liability in frat house cases where, you know, knuckleheads are, you know, drinking too much beer or that sort of stuff. So they tend not to be the most serious of crimes. You know, is there potential for danger? Absolutely. So I don't want to minimize that. But in the real world, when courts are looking at the language used by the legislature in enacting a law, and the language is silent on the level of mens rea required for the crime, courts will often imply that there is either general intent or specific intent if the crime results in a significant penalty. And by significant, I mean prison time. Generally speaking, when we talk about strict liability offenses, more often than not, the penalty is going to begin with a fine, and if there's incarceration, it's a relatively short period of time. So, any questions so far? Because if not, then we can use the rest of the time to go through some of these cases and we'll hopefully illustrate some of the principles.
Yes? And what about the common law? Do states, will they use rulings from other states for common law?
Yes. And in fact, we've already had one example of that. If you go back to the case out of West Virginia and the automatism defense, that is what we call a case of first impression in West Virginia. And so for the Supreme Court of West Virginia, I'm sorry, the Court of Appeals of West Virginia, they don't have a Supreme Court in West Virginia. The Court of Appeals for West Virginia, in order for them to craft this defense, they needed to consider how other jurisdictions have handled facts of this nature. Okay?
That's what I thought about. I wasn't real clear on how they came up with that, because it seemed to be saying that West Virginia didn't have the law that they needed.
That's correct. That's correct. And that's an example of judges making law. And oftentimes what happens is that if the legislature doesn't like the law that has been made by the judge or a judges, then the legislature will step in and change the law, and then the court can't do anything about that change unless their decision was grounded in federal constitutional law. So everyone who becomes a legislator in every part of this country takes an oath to uphold the U.S. Constitution as well as their state constitution. And the first oath that they take is to uphold the United States Constitution. So state legislators cannot cavalierly violate the federal constitution. And so if a state court created a defense or created a crime, and the legislature And most often what we're talking about is, let's say, the state court invalidating a law, and then the legislature says, hey, we know what we want, but the state court struck down that law, let's say because it violated due process or some other part of the Constitution, then that's a matter that's likely to end up in the federal courts, and the federal courts would then decide on who was right. Okay.
Can a defendant make a constitutional challenge in a state court?
Yes. Happens every day. In fact, a defendant who doesn't have a lawyer who makes a state claim and a federal claim is probably engaging in malpractice. Okay. All right. So let's take a look at the cases and see if we can clear up. Oh crap! Clear up some of the ambiguities. And the first case we should take a look at is at 139, State versus Smith. Who was it that called to want to know if the cookout was still on? Yeah, it wasn't even one of you guys. I got a call from somebody wanting to know whether it was still on. Why wouldn't it be? Well, it's raining. Well, if you look at our building, we've got this huge overhang, and we've got this open courtroom. We can still do this thing. We are.
Is the cookout still on, dude?
Now, you know I have difficulty not saying bad words, so don't go there. Well, I do try. I guess I'll have to do this from your briefs. Emily?
Yep. Okay. Steve Smith, the facts of the case are the defendant is inmate at a county jail on June 11th, 1989. He's aware that he had HIV. On several occasions before the state, he threatened to kill correction officers by spitting on them or biting them. On the day, June 11th, he bit an officer in his hand, causing puncture wounds on the skin in a struggle which he initiated. So, the legal history is the trial court found the defendant guilty of attempted murder. The defendant appealed, and the Superior Court of New Jersey appellate division finds him guilty.
Okay. Take a look at page 140. Take a look at page 140, but do you recall what this guy is charged with?
Attempted murder, but also aggravated assault.
Okay. All right. At the bottom paragraph, this is an example of the model penal code, where you have a definition given to a crime. And so we're told criminal attempt is, and then the pertinent parts of the statute. Definition of attempt. A person is guilty of an attempt to commit a crime if acting with the kind of culpability otherwise required for commission of the crime, he purposefully engages in conduct which would constitute a crime if the attendant circumstances were, and note the next two words, were as a reasonable person would believe them to be. And then in the second paragraph, you have when causing a particular result is an element of the crime, or purposely omits. So, we're given the definition of attempt. What is the actus reus? What is the actus reus in that definition of attempt? What act would you have to do to be charged with attempt? I'm sorry? Or at least attempts to. So we're talking about some act in furtherance of the commission of a crime. Okay? And then in terms of the mens rea, we're told that the person is acting with a kind of culpability otherwise required for the commission of the crime. So that's an example of how one might parse a statute and look at it in terms of the act and the mental state. Given, we're told you're acting with a kind of culpability otherwise required for commission of the crime, and then we get more language. If this were a common law jurisdiction, we would say that this is a specific intent crime because the mental state here is loaded with all kinds of things. So that's just one point. But to return to the facts of the Smith case for a moment. So he is charged with attempted murder, he's charged with attempted murder. And what is he found guilty of? Found guilty of attempted murder. Okay. So then now we're forced to some extent, we get to play judge and jury here. After the case is presented to the jury, what I just pointed out on page 140 would be read to the jurors. And the judge would say, ladies and gentlemen, you have heard testimony about the defendant being HIV positive. You have heard testimony that the defendant threatened and did bite a corrections officer. That at the time that he was biting the corrections officer, he was telling the officer that I intend to give you HIV, which is going to cause your death. And the defendant put on evidence to suggest that it was impossible, legally, physically, whatever impossible, for anybody to contract the virus in the way that I intended. Okay, so that's his defense, all right? And so the judge will say, now, go back to your chambers and apply the law to the facts. And so that's what happens here. And so, given the law, given the facts, is he guilty of attempted murder?
Yes.
Yes? Why? Yeah, I suppose. I mean, part of what happens, and you know, you're asking about what does the court do with the case in first impression and all that sort of stuff. The date of this case is what? 1993. In 1993, do we know more now about how you contract HIV than we did in 1993? Okay. And in fact, this event actually takes place at 89. And so perhaps today, a reasonable person wouldn't believe that. But then a reasonable person did. And so the court says, we're fine with the conviction here for attempted murder because these victims, or the victim, actually believed that he would contract the HIV virus and was likely to die. Yes?
What if he did something that was, like, completely, I don't know, innocuous as opposed to biting, like, lick his face or said, I'm going to scratch you or something like that? What do you think he would have been convicted of attempted murder?
It's possible. I mean, that's, you know, as you all are asking me questions, asking yourselves questions, remember that you can't ask that question in a vacuum. When you ask that question, the question ought to be, assuming all the other facts, what if we change this particular item? And so, with that as a backdrop, I'd say the result would be the same. Because you, at that time, we knew that there was something about the exchange of fluids. Okay. Hell, in sports, in the National Basketball Association, they still stop play if someone has a cut in the middle of a basketball game. What's that about? Well, yeah, it is about Magic or Tragic Johnson. I was actually with the Lakers and the Celtics the night that that announcement was made. In one of my other lives, I actually did some sports writing, and so I happened to be covering the Celtics and Lakers that night in Worcester as an exhibition game. But, you know, we knew nothing about it. That was now, I think, 25 years ago. And, you know, Magic looks as healthy as a horse. Okay. So, and is as big as a horse, but that's a whole other story. But in this case, it's okay to charge this murder. And as I said, the structure is one of the model penal code. And so, yeah, you get to see it. And in fact, in this case, you see the judge's actual instruction. At common law, and God help me for even opening this can of worms, at common law, there was this defense of impossibility. Just leave it at that. There was this defense of impossibility. The model penal code removes that as a potential defense. But that is really at the heart of the defendant's argument here. It was impossible for me to cause what I said I was trying to do. And so this case really turns on the intent of the perpetrator as it would be perceived by a reasonable person. Okay? All right. People versus Hood at 143. I'm trying to remember, and if I've called on you before, just speak out. Renata? Well, I sort of remembered you from California, right?
Yep.
Okay.
Okay, so at 2 a.m., the defendant and his brother and a friend, all of whom had been drinking, knocked on the door of the defendant's ex-girlfriend's house. They asked to use the bathroom, and when she said no, he barged his way in and knocked through the floor and kicked her. Then the brother took her aside and Susan's next door neighbor was awakened by the screams and called the police. When the police got there, Susan came running and crying to the door, told them that they were in the kitchen, and they observed them sitting in the kitchen, and the defendant asked if they had a warrant. They said they didn't need it because they had permission to enter, and the defendant then directed a stream of obscenities at the police officers, and that was in violation of the penal code, so they attempted to arrest him. And in the attempt to arrest him, the defendant swung a fist at the officer and knocked him down. And during the struggle, the defendant took the officer's gun and fired two shots. The brother jumped on the back of the other officer, and the third officer came in and testified that he saw the defendant point the gun toward the officer's midsection and pull the trigger twice. Finally, the officer was able to regain possession of the gun, and they sedated the defendant. And the officer noticed that the defendant had shot him once in each leg.
Defendant shot one of the police officers?
The defendant shot Officer Aaliyah once in each leg.
Okay. What are the charges here?
The charges are assault with a deadly weapon upon a police officer, battery upon a police officer, and with assault with intent to murder Officer Aaliyah.
Okay. So, you frequently will hear that someone faced three counts or four counts. This is a three-count indictment, three separate charges. What does the jury say as to count one?
They found him guilty on count one.
And count two?
Count two, they found him not guilty.
Count three?
They found him guilty.
Okay, so the defendant is appealing. the conviction of, on counts one and three, correct?
Yes.
Okay. So what's at the heart of the defendant's defense here?
He states that the court failed to properly instruct the jury on the effect of intoxication with respect to his offenses.
Okay. This is the easiest case to make the point. When we talk about errors in a case, the error can be because a judge admitted evidence that was really important or excluded evidence that was really important. But more often than not, the cases that we read will focus on whether there was sufficient evidence to justify a conviction, so that's a due process claim, or there's going to be an argument that the judge incorrectly instructed the jury on the rule of law. So this is one of those cases where the defendant is asserting that the judge made an error in the instruction. And if you find that there was an error in the instruction, then that means that the case gets tipped. It doesn't mean that the person gets walked, but it means that they're entitled to a new trial. Okay. What does the court say about this?
The theory that the justice explored was that evidence of intoxication could be considered to negate intent, whatever intent was an element of the crime charge.
Okay. Does it negate the intent for count one?
No.
Why not?
It was a voluntary act to get drunk, and he was a voluntary act to grab the gun and assault him with a deadly weapon.
Okay, let's go to count three. Does it negate the intent, or potentially negate the intent for count three?
Yes.
Okay, good. All right. California is one of those interesting states. Technically, it is a model penal code state. But frequently, common law interpretations get thrown into the mix. And this case is a case that's dated, and so I suspect that the California legislature has adopted language that is less ambiguous in terms of the code, but at the time they had not. At common law, we would say that intoxication may be a defense if a person is charged with a specific intent crime. And so, in a true common law jurisdiction, Hood would have been entitled to that instruction on both counts. But the California court says, wait a minute. What happens if we excuse everybody who gets ossified for an assault? What happens? What do you think happens? You're potentially not guilty because you're ossified. inebriated. Had a Zachary night. You've got a potential defense. Do we like that? No, hell no. People drink all the time. And in fact, one of the byproducts of drinking is that frequently your inhibitions are relaxed. They go away. And you do stupid things. And so what California is fearful of is that if a person is charged with assault, and the word assault automatically means that intoxication is a potential defense, we're going to have knuckleheads all over the place kicking the crap out of each other and saying, I'm not guilty because I was drunk.
Didn't they say that
more
times than not, assault and drinking?
Yes, and in fact, we know that statistically that there's a relationship between the violence and the whatever. So the California court says, in all due respect to the common law, this distinction between specific intent and general intent isn't going to apply to a mere assault and battery. However, where we're talking about an assault with intent to murder, that's different. Now we're talking about an offense that is really serious, and generally requires some level of consciousness in order to commit the crime. And so we are not going to will allow you to have an instruction in that case, or we, you know, it may be appropriate, but it's not going to be inappropriate for mere assault. And we'll see other cases that handle this matter in exactly the same way. The state of New Jersey, which is also a model penal code state, does not recognize voluntary intoxication as a defense. So this person on remand is likely to be convicted of the assault, and then as to the assault to commit murder, it's going to be up to the jury to look at all of the facts. And one could still look at these facts and say, hey, this guy took a gun from an officer, discharged it twice. It required the assistance of a third officer. We don't think that he was so drunk that he didn't understand. And that's essentially what happens. When the jury gets the instruction on intoxication, they'll have to weigh the facts. Did the alcohol really impair his or her reasoning to understand what they were doing? If it did, then they're not guilty. But what's the probability of that? You know, I don't know. It's going to depend upon all of the facts. And we don't know how long these people have been drinking, and so there are lots of things. And so maybe the best way to resolve this is to affirm the conviction on the assault and battery, acknowledge that there was a flaw in the assault to murder, and then the prosecutor can figure out whether they want to go after this person on the assault to commit murder. All right, so in these two cases, we've looked at what essentially would be called specific intent crimes. If we're talking true model penal code, we're talking about crimes committed purposely, intentionally. And you've been introduced to a defense for the first time. As I said, I'm going to leave these materials here. I want to get downstairs and protect the food for you. So I realize that there are some cases that we need to go through, and we'll take the first half hour class to go through the cases that we haven't at least covered. And I'll, as I said, I'll go protect the food. There are lots of people in the building looking for free food. So we'll start homicide on Monday. Next week should be a good week, by the way.